It's the NPR News Update podcast for Monday, December 22nd. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota News on your schedule. Today, fallout from Saturday's protest at the Mall of America. Low-income women have problems with landlords. MedTech firms are poised to advance their cause in a new Congress. Minnesotans go from fighting bad guys to fighting fires. And the Gophers ready for a big bowl game, but it might not mean a big payoff. First, the Minnesota Vikings say they have sold 30,000 seat licenses for their new stadium. The seat licenses prompted controversy when the team unveiled their plan to charge fans one-time fees of up to $9,500 at their new home. Governor Mark Dayton accused the team of sneaking the charge into the stadium deal with the state. But fans are buying them anyway, according to Jason Gonella. He's with Van Wagner, the company hired by the Vikings to market the team. Fans have put down $80 million in the first 9 months of sales.
We'd originally budgeted to do just around $35 million for the year. So to be at this level this early in the game is tremendous, and I think it really just speaks volumes for how dedicated the fan base is here, and people really stepped up.
The stadium is scheduled to open in 2016. The head of the Minneapolis Police Union says the fatal ambush shooting of two New York City police officers Saturday in Brooklyn is a reminder of how dangerous the job is. John Delmonico, the president of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, says the shootings are on the minds of all police officers.
In my travels every day, I run into cops, and in the last day, I've talked to a lot of cops, and it's kind of the topic of conversation. And, I think for cops everywhere, it's kind of a big reality check.
The suspect in the New York shooting allegedly wrote he planned to shoot officers and was angry about the deaths of two black men at the hands of white police officers. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto is condemning the Saturday killings but has not made major changes in protocol for officers. A protest over the recent police killings of unarmed black men in the U.S. drew well over 1,000 people to the Mall of America on Saturday. Demonstrators flooded the mall's rotunda in spite of warnings they could be cited for trespassing on private property. More than two dozen were arrested, as Curtis Gilbert reports.
The Mall of America has a long-standing policy banning protests. It tried to head off the event and threatened to have the organizers arrested, but that only succeeded in drawing more attention to the protest.
This is our property!
This is our property!
Police conservatively estimated the crowd at around 1,500. Organizers say it was twice that size. Whatever the number, the group was largely peaceful and highly organized. Police arrested 25 of the demonstrators. The crowd chanted slogans about the recent deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner on Staten Island, and Tamir Rice in Cleveland. They also tried to leaven the tragedies with some holiday cheer.
Black lives matter. It's time to let them know. Injustice anywhere is injustice for us.
The mall stepped up security for the event and screened the bags of shoppers entering the building. Security officers closed about 80 stores in the East Wing during the protest, the main part of which lasted about an hour. The group Black Lives Matter, which earlier this month shut down part of 35W, called the Mall of America event its biggest success yet. Mall Vice President Dan Jasper says it caused economic hardship for the employees on a busy shopping day the weekend before Christmas.
A lot of those jobs that are at Mall of America are commission jobs. This week is incredibly important to them, and this did have an impact on them.
More than 100 police officers were on hand for the protest. Bloomington Police Commander Mark Stelick says he wished the protesters had taken the city up on its offer to hold the event on nearby public property.
Once it was clear that it was going to take place, our goal was to end it as quickly as we could, and our primary goal was to ensure the safety and security for the people in the mall, the guests, the tenants, the cops involved, the protesters involved, and to that end, that was successful.
Stelick says as far as he knows, no one was hurt and no property was damaged. The demonstrators began in the building's rotunda, then marched outside and blocked a street for about 20 minutes. That's when Curtis Mayfield Jr. encountered them, the Iraq war vet, who says he's the son of the late music legend Curtis Mayfield, was ringing a bell for the Salvation Army. He put it down and joined the crowd. Instead of chanting Black Lives Matter, though, Mayfield made it All Lives Matter.
My father wrote a song, Heaven or Hell Below, if there's one, we're all gonna go. We people that are darker than blue, We struggle so much, but it's just the beginning of equality for all life, not just black lives, all lives.
But he says he supports their cause just the same. There were also demonstrations this weekend in other cities. On Friday night, more than 70 people were arrested in Milwaukee after they shut down a road to protest a police shooting of a black man there earlier this year. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Bloomington.
A couple of Twin Cities women sued their landlords this month, accusing them of making sexual advances and intruding on their privacy. The lawsuits offer a glimpse into some of the pressures low-income women face in a tight rental market with historically low vacancy rates. Laura Ewan has the story.
Kimberly Malko stares down the one-and-a-half-story house in Richfield that she moved into in 2008. At the time, she figured she was lucky. She could manage the $800 rent, and it had a yard for her dogs and kids.
This is the house where I thought my children and I were going to have a home. And it was hell. It wasn't a home.
Malko is 42 with piercing blue eyes. That's something her landlord remarked on shortly after she moved in. Malko says his tone rubbed her the wrong way, and then his observations grew more inappropriate.
I would hear comments about my breast all the time. That was really uncomfortable. That was the last thing you expected a landlord to say to you, and that you're beautiful and that you have a nice shape. And
she says her landlord, Harvey Tam, called her up to five times a day, visited her repeatedly without warning, and even barged in on her after Malko's father told Tam she was breastfeeding her baby. After 2 years of living in the house, Malko confronted Tam and asked him to stop harassing her. She says he responded by evicting her. Malko was late on her payments, but says Tam had always told her he would work with her because he was behind on making several repairs. Malko says she wound up homeless for several months and had to split up her family. All of these allegations are outlined in a lawsuit Malko filed earlier this month. Contacted by NPR News, Tam said the claims were false, but he wouldn't elaborate, and his attorney declined to comment on the case. Malko knows she's not the perfect victim. She has three additional evictions on file. And she says it might be hard for others to believe her story, especially when they learn that months after she was evicted, she moved back into the same house for a second time with Harvey Tam as her landlord.
I was scared and kind of happy at the same time because, you know, I could bring my family back together again. You know, I have my children, my animals, and just kind of feel normal.
She says when she complained to Tam again in 2013 about the alleged harassment, he evicted her for a second time. But experts say it's these women with checkered rental histories and limited housing options who are the most vulnerable. Retired University of Illinois professor Louise Fitzgerald has studied sexual harassment in rental housing. She says in many of the cases she's seen, the landlord will demand sex in exchange for rent. Fitzgerald says most victims are poor and feel trapped.
Most of them are single mothers. They're not well educated. They're usually not employed or they're underemployed. Many of them don't even know that this is illegal, and nobody really tells them. So they don't know to complain, or they're afraid to complain.
Fitzgerald says it's hard to say how many of these cases exist because they're underreported and no one tracks them. But she's testified in several cases the federal government has brought against predatory landlords, and she says the harassment appears to be prevalent. Jill Galding of the nonprofit Gender Justice says some landlords feel they can intrude on a tenant's privacy simply because they hold a key to the property. Galding's group and the tenants' rights organization, Homeline, are also representing another woman who alleges her landlord installed a camera in her bathroom so he could spy on her while she was in the shower.
There's this notion of sort of ownership and entitlement, and there seems to be a sense by some landlords that when they're renting property to women, that that's also, in a sense, giving them access to the women as sex objects.
Over the past decade in Minnesota and Wisconsin, the federal government has sued abusive landlords with some success. In one case, the property manager of a rooming house in New Richmond was accused of sexually harassing a homeless woman who sought residence there. As part of a settlement with the government, he's been permanently barred from managing rental properties. But lawyers who work on these cases say if a landlord harasses one tenant, there are usually other victims out there. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
When senior citizens and their advocates push for funding increases next year at the Minnesota State Capitol, they will make their case to a new House committee. Tim Pugmire reports.
Republicans in the Minnesota House created a committee on aging and long-term care policy for the 2015 session. GOP Representative Joe Schumacher of Laverne, the panel's chair, said he plans to look at funding and workforce issues for nursing homes and other care programs. Schumacher said he also wants to discuss potential incentives for people who plan and save for their own long-term care.
Something that gives people more options as they grow older because they take control of their future.
Schumacher said combining elderly and long-term care issues in one committee will give them the extra attention they deserve. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
When the new Congress starts work next month, one of its first major policy initiatives is likely to get a lot of attention from a local industry. Many in Congress want to repeal the tax on medical devices that helps pay for the Affordable Care Act. Minnesota companies such as Medtronic and St. Jude Medical stand to keep millions of dollars more of their profits if the tax is repealed. As Brett Neely reports, there's been a long and sophisticated lobbying campaign behind the movement to undo the tax.
The knives have been out for the medical device tax almost from the moment Congress passed the Affordable Care Act. The tax raises about $3 billion a year, and industry executives say it hurts their companies. With Republicans now in charge of both chambers of Congress and key Democrats, including both of Minnesota senators, on their side, supporters say a repeal bill could reach the president's desk by springtime. J.C. Scott is the top lobbyist for the industry trade group AdvaMed.
The tax has now been in effect for 2 years and is having a daily impact on medical device companies, and we make sure that we're always talking to policymakers about that. That's been our approach.
This is a great case study of how you lobby, how you have a clear strategy, theme, and message that's focused on a very narrow area.
That's James Thurber, a political science professor at American University who studies lobbying. Thurber says the industry has continually argued that the tax hurts startup companies, even though it's big firms like Medtronic and Boston Scientific that pay the bulk of the tax. Thurber calls that tactic a reframe of the debate.
In a reframe, you show that it really hits America generally, hits a lot of small businesses.
A recent study by Congress's in-house think tank, the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service, shows, for example, that in the very worst-case scenario, the tax may have cost the industry 1,200 jobs nationwide, while industry-sponsored research says the tax may have been responsible for 30,000 lost jobs in 2013. Third District Republican Congressman Eric Paulson has led the push to repeal the law in the House. When asked about the CRS report's findings, he was dismissive.
Well, you know, CRS does these academic reports, but, you know, when you talk to someone who lost their job in North Carolina, you know, that's a real job loss that impacts that family.
Again, James Thurber.
Anecdotes and stories are more effective than statistics.
Thurber says anecdotes shift attention away from empirical studies and the kind of factual, unbiased economic analysis that the Congressional Research Service specializes in. There's another problem with repealing the tax. Under congressional budget rules, any new spending or tax cuts have to be offset with new revenue or spending cuts elsewhere. So the tax's opponents will need to come up with the $30 billion the tax is expected to bring in over the next decade. J.C. Scott at AdvaMed says his group has no plans to offer any suggestions.
We look at that as a problem that the Congress has to wrestle with, and that it's not necessarily appropriate for us on the industry side to be trying to solve that pay-for dynamic.
American University's James Thurber says that's a good way to avoid getting into fights with other industries and interest groups that could be affected by spending cuts.
It's a wise strategy, although it's not very honest, in my opinion.
Not honest because fiscal trade-offs are an inherent component of the political process. Ultimately, the industry has spent an estimated $30 million a year since 2008 on lobbying and has nearly 400 lobbyists tackling the issue, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. When asked about the industry's efforts, lobbyist J.C. Scott says he doesn't know specific numbers.
I will say the level of emphasis that you see placed by our organization, others in the medical device space, is just an indicator of how much of a priority it is to address this issue, and that's a result of the really severe impact that the policy is having on the industry.
Scott says he's cautiously optimistic the industry will prevail next year, and if it doesn't, history suggests the device companies will keep trying until they do. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The Minneapolis Fire Department graduated its newest class of firefighters on Friday, and nearly all of them are veterans. As the economy improves, the employment gap for veterans is closing. Sasha Aslanian reports.
Firefighter Ryan Schnabel.
At a morning graduation ceremony, Minneapolis Fire Chief John Friedel pinned badges on the chests of his new firefighters. The men beat out a pool of 5,000 applicants for these jobs. 12 of the 13 are veterans. Friedel says a recent law change makes veterans even stronger candidates.
There are a number of veterans coming back from overseas, and they've done a lot of great work for this country. And the country is paying back a little bit. And with us, when we started our testing and examination process, there are some veterans points that are applied. Of our last 53 hires, 47 of them have been veterans.
The state's new Veterans Preference Law awards 10 points to veterans and 15 points to veterans with disabilities applying for civil service jobs. It's one of a number of state and federal incentives aimed at closing the employment gap for veterans. During the recession, veterans suffered higher unemployment rates than the general population. Returning post-9/11 vets had a particularly difficult time. They were returning to a weak economy and widespread media attention on the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dane Conkins, who was part of today's graduating class, served two deployments in the Marine Corps as a heavy equipment operator in Afghanistan. The 24-year-old says when he made the transition back into civilian life in 2012, no one made him feel like damaged goods.
You know, I think for the most part, people are very positive. You know, you do wonder, you know, what people think, you know, oh my goodness, is he going to start freaking out while he's just trying to do a simple task? You know, is he just going to leave? Is he going to start throwing stuff? You know, whatever the case may be. But I think a lot of progress has been made with issues like PTSD. You know, I think there's a lot more research and stuff that can help us now. And sometimes I think the biggest thing for, you know, two Marine Corps combat vets is sometimes it's just nice to have someone to talk to, you know, just, you know, very simple therapy.
His classmate, 29-year-old Ryan Schnabel, is another former Marine. Schnabel spent a total of 20 months fighting in Fallujah and the Baghdad area. He says he thinks his combat experience will serve him well in the fire department.
I mean, the first time I got shot at in Iraq, the first thing that happens is your adrenaline dumps, your hands stop working, and you don't know what to do. You just want to crawl. You don't know if to crawl up in a ball or start shooting back, and your training comes into play. And I think that having that experience will only make us stronger firefighters.
Schnabel said he's had to deal with the lingering effects of war, but it hasn't held him back.
I wanted to open people's eyes as well, too, and you hear the things all the time, people talking about PTSD or being angry, and that it's, I mean, you can look at me, I'm a functioning person in society right now, and I'm 50% disabled PTSD.
Schnabel and Conkins are upbeat about making the transition from fighting wars to fighting fires. And they're part of an upswing in veteran employment in Minnesota. The Department of Employment and Economic Development says unemployment among veterans in Minnesota is now slightly lower than among non-vets. Jim Finley, director of Veterans Employment Programs for DEED, says Minnesota's strong economy is helping boost veteran employment in the public as well as private sectors.
I believe that employers really are getting the message on a lot of this and the value that veterans bring to a business. As an example, you don't have to teach a veteran when 8 o'clock comes because they're there at 7:45. They see 8 o'clock come when the boss sees it come. So there's a lot of those soft skills, too, in addition to job-specific skills that make veterans such a hot commodity right now.
Finley says the issue the state's facing now is finding enough veterans to fill the jobs in the companies that want to hire them. Sasha Aslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Farmers will get a financial break from falling fuel costs, but it won't be enough to offset lower crop prices. Mark Stile has more.
2014 has been a bad year for crop prices, with corn sinking well below the break-even point. It costs more than $700 an acre on average to plant and harvest an acre of corn. Fuel makes up less than 5% of that total. So University of Minnesota Extension economist Bill Lazarus says while the fuel price drop helps, it's just not enough to bail out most farmers who are in the red.
It's probably not going to make a difference between profit and loss.
Diesel fuel accounts for the majority of farm fuel, but it's only fallen about half the rate of gasoline prices so far this year. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
When the University of Minnesota plays January 1st in the Citrus Bowl against Missouri, the Gophers will receive a lot more national exposure than they have in years past, but they won't get much of a payoff. Higher education reporter Alex Friedrich has spoken to university officials and football industry experts to find out why, and he talked with Tom Cran about it on Friday.
The Citrus Bowl is one of the higher-profile games on New Year's Day in the College Bowl season. How much money is at stake here?
Well, you're right, and the Citrus Bowl is a cut above the Insight Bowl, the Meineke Carr Bowl, and some of the others that the Gophers have played in recent years. I mean, the team hasn't played in a big New Year's Day bowl since the 1962 Rose Bowl. And the payout is decent. We're talking more than $4 million. But the U is not going to be getting that money. Instead, it's going to go to the Big Ten, along with all the other bowl money from the other teams. The conference puts it into a pot along with money from things like, you know, TV contracts, and then divvies it up equally at the end of the year. Other conferences, you know, do the same thing. So a team gets the same amount of money whether it goes to a big bowl game or just stays home. A Penn State lecturer I talked to joked it was kind of a, you know, socialist model. Now, because the Big Ten has an agreement with the Citrus Bowl, it was going to have a Big Ten team in the game anyway, whether it was the Gophers or someone else. So yeah, the conference was going to get that $4 million no matter what.
How much will the U of M then get from the conference this year?
Well, spokesman told me it should be about $31 million, which compares to about $28 million last year. And that's about a third or so of the university's athletic budget. Now, although that's the usual share for a member, the new Big Ten teams, and we're talking Rutgers and Maryland, those guys don't get their full shares yet, and Penn State is still under some financial sanctions.
So the university gets the same amount as if another Big Ten team was in the bowl.
That's right.
They don't get any more for being there themselves.
No.
So what about the Citrus Bowl trip itself? How much is all that going to cost?
Well, the trip is where the school can actually lose money if it does it up big. The Big Ten is giving Minnesota $2 million for travel and accommodation. And with that kind of money, it'll transport people, house them, feed them, and the whole bowl delegation. The spokesman told me they don't know how big the delegation is going to be yet, but it'll include the team, the marching band, spirit squads, and senior officials. They're going to fly down December 29th and return just after the game on January 1st. Now, that's got to be a pretty big group to take care of over several days, and I'm told that $2 million won't go as far as you might think. But the U says it doesn't intend to go over that amount. Now, it is spending about $10,000 to help subsidize a $299 bowl visit deal for student season ticket holders. It includes a bus trip to the bowl, two nights in a hotel, a ticket to the game, and a season ticket for next year's Gopher games.
Do we know how many packages the U has sold there?
It's set aside about six buses, which each holds about 45 students each, and that the U has filled all of those, and so far it's sold about 7,300 of its 9,000 allotted tickets. That's already a lot better than it did for the Texas Bowl last year. That time it sold 3,400 tickets or so out of about 12,000. If the school doesn't sell all the tickets this time, it's not a big deal. The Big Ten will buy the remainder and take that cost out of the big pool that it divides up among the teams.
So will there be any sort of payoff here for the Gophers?
Well, the Penn State lecturer says the university has the potential to make money indirectly from all the national exposure it gets. And he says a big bowl can help go for T-shirt sales, for example. It might give the university more marketing power and maybe lead to increased donations. And he says it might draw more prospective students to apply to the U.
Alex Friedrich, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You can read more by Alex about the Citrus Bowl and the finances at nprnews.org.
That's Alex Friedrich and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update podcast, back tomorrow with the Tuesday news.